growing up in Canton, Ohio, developing an interest in music and eventually heading off to college, but just relentlessly playing music on the side with friends, with bands, Macy Gray started to make a bit of a name for herself, but also found a ton of struggle. Early deals with major record labels that just didn't pan out, and yet along with all of this struggle, she refused to give up. Finally, in 1999, she broke through in the music world with her iconic song, I Try, selling more than 25 million albums, winning a Grammy, 2 Brit Awards. She was on top of the world, but the journey that got her there was really hard. And the years that would follow would bring even more challenge, but often of a different nature, including the pressures of managing fame and the introduction of drugs to her world. Having landed in a more grounded place in life now, more seasoned, wiser, focused intensely on her work, her fierce creative talent and powerful, distinct voice have opened the door to tours, new albums, even appearances on screen, acting alongside people like Denzel Washington and so many others. Her most recent album, Ruby, with the song Buddha, where she collaborates with one of my favorite players out there right now, Gary Clark Jr., offers a line that really seems to be her current mantra. I'm all right now. So, really excited to share this conversation and Macy's journey with you. I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Good Life Project is sponsored by the ADHD Aha podcast hosted by Laura Key. So I've been kind of amazed at how many conversations I've had lately with people later in life who are wondering if they have ADHD. It can be hard to understand what ADHD is by looking at a list of symptoms. So in each episode of ADHD Aha, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, even funny ways that ADHD symptoms surface for adults. Like the recent episode with ADHD coach Emily Weinberg, which really resonated with me. Her story about how she was thinking she was, quote, just lazy before her diagnosis because she wasn't hyperactive really struck a chord. Her feeling frozen and stuck, ruminating on mounting to-do lists is just so relatable for so many people. It's really validating to hear others articulate those experiences. Each episode of ADHD Aha features candid tales of realizing that your loved one has ADHD. You'll hear the unexpected, emotional ways that it manifests in adults through heartfelt interviews. ADHD Aha captures the authentic human experience of ADHD. So if you want a fresh, personal perspective that embraces the messiness, listen to ADHD Aha. Search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha with Aha spelled A-H-A. It's an aha moment you won't miss. Yeah, so good to be hanging out with you. I know it's weird times, right? Because you're in New York City playing it. You know, like you were here to play a show at the Beacon. Mm-hmm. On the day that sort of like New York says, okay, all shows are shut down.
They just, because of the 500 capacity thing, they didn't, there was no public ticket sales.
Oh.
It was only, they called it friends and family. There was people on the list and it was huge. It went on for 5 hours.
No kidding.
Yeah, they had everybody. It was Dave Matthews, Black Crowes, Jackson Browne, me, Joss Stone, everybody. Leon Bridges.
Was
Cyndi Lauper.
Was Jimmy Vaughn in it? Because I know he was up for that show last
Jimmy
year.
Jimmy Vaughn was there. Fucks and Tedeschi.
Yeah. So I kind of want to bounce around, like just explore some different things for you. I mean, you're originally from Ohio, Canton area.
Yeah, Canton, Ohio.
Yeah. Do you have fond memories of growing up there?
Of course, yeah. I had a cool childhood. You know, my mom was a teacher. My dad worked at a factory and he had a barbershop. And it's Midwest, so it's pretty boring and simple, but it's a good way to grow up, though. Because you have your values first and stuff like that.
So was your dad's barbershop sort of like that classical barbershop that you think of where it's just kind of like it's the hub where everyone's hanging out chatting?
Yeah, it was like four old guys. They actually called themselves Old Timers. They had an Old Timers Club.
Oh, that's awesome.
And like the same customers they had had since they started were still coming there. It was always packed, always talking. But it was like old man lingo, you know?
Yeah.
It's like stuff they talk about. I didn't know what was going on.
Did you hang out there much or not really?
I was always there because I had to go there after school and wait for him to take me home. On Saturdays, my mom would drop me off there if she had something to do, you know, because I couldn't be home by myself.
Yeah. So you're like
a
fixture.
I was always at the barber shop. Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. He taught me how to cut a little bit.
Oh, did you really?
A little bit. I'm not as good as he was. I can do a proper fade and a lineup. I can line your hair up pretty nice.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it must have been so fun also because, like, I just like that. I mean, I think so many stories get told, like, when you're kind of, like, kicking around an environment like that. And, like, I think people come clean. They get honest and they just sort of, like, you get to know what's really happening sort of, like, around certain people's lives and settings like that.
Yeah, it's cool. The thing about the Midwest is it's honest. Like, people there's no nuance when you meet somebody from Ohio. They kind of is what it is. You are what you are. Kind of. Because I live in LA, so that's all nuance.
Totally different. Right.
There's nothing but nuance. So it's cool. It's a cool way to grow. It's a good start, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like I'm a New Yorker. I grew up just outside of New York. I've been in the city for 30 years.
Oh,
so
really?
It's sort of like, this is kind of what I know, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
LA is kind of a similar vibe, but not quite. It's sort of.
No, LA is a whole nother planet. You have to live there to know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. What part of LA are you in?
I live in the Valley.
Yeah.
But I've lived all over LA. I've been out there since I was 17. I went there to go to school. I went to USC.
Right.
And I've kind of been out there ever since.
You are, so, I mean, when does music enter your life? I mean, like it sounds like you actually, like, was piano the first exposure for you, or was there something else?
Piano when I was 7.
Yeah.
I took piano lessons.
Was that voluntary, or was that, like, your parents saying, you will learn an instrument?
Oh, yeah, that was all forced. Yeah. That was all torture.
Did you like it? I mean, was there...
No, I hated it. My teacher was, like, 1,000 years old. And she was really slow. And, you know, like, today I see a lot of teachers, like, when I took my kids to get piano lessons, they would say, tell me your favorite song, and I'll teach you how to play your favorite song, you know? But when I was coming up, it was all theory and technique and classical training and stuff like that.
Yeah, so it's like scales and doing all the stuff that is...
Yeah, super boring.
Right.
But it's cool to know all that stuff. I don't regret it.
It's
cool to, you know. I get to impress the guys with my knowledge of scales.
Yeah. Has the theory side stayed with you over the years?
Oh, yeah. That's stuff you never forget. It's like going to school. You never forget math and stuff like that.
Do you still play piano?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I know when you compose, it's mostly just by voice, right? Or when you're sort of like thinking of when you're actually like writing.
Yeah, I've written some stuff on the guitar. It's weird. I'm not a guitar player, but I know the chords.
Yeah.
So all the songs that I've written the music for, I wrote them on a guitar.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
Even since like the early days?
Yeah, I wrote I Tried on the guitar.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, because I didn't have a piano at my house.
Yeah.
Today. I do now.
Right. I guess it takes a lot less space to do it on guitar. Does. It's like, especially in the early days where like most of us have these little studios or something like that.
I know. Guitars are so portable.
Yeah, no, for sure. So that's like your early exposure, but it sounds like it didn't land well. Did you stay with it long enough where like you turned the corner and you hit a point where you like sort of like learned enough where it started to become fun, or for you was it always just kind of like I'm doing this because I have to and I can't wait to be done?
No, piano lessons I always hated, and I had to take it till I was in high school, and then But it sticks with you. And you do, without even realizing it, you you start writing songs, you know, start getting ideas. And you listen to music differently than most people.
Tell me more about that. How so?
Like, you listen to, I don't know. I listen to a lot of production. I listen to, like, you hear detail a lot when you're a musician. And voice, and, you know, you can tell when somebody's flat. You know, whereas the average person doesn't really care if somebody's flat. Do you know what I mean? Like when rappers sing, it just really bothers me because they can't sing, because they're singing away. But most people, like my son, doesn't really care. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So yeah. Your son's in the business now? Or?
He's actually written songs for a couple artists, but he's not, like, it's not his whole thing yet, no.
Yeah.
He's 23. He's still figuring it out.
It's interesting, too, that you say you can kind of hear it when somebody's off a little bit, because these days, when I have a bunch of friends who are sort of like in the business, and they pretty much all say that almost any producer that you work with these days, it's almost like you almost don't have a choice to go through auto-tune and go through all these things where it basically kind of makes you sound as perfect as they can.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, do you find that that's the experience still?
Yeah, there's plenty of machines, but you can still hear, if you're a musician, you can still hear the off, like you can hear the auto-tune. You know what I mean? There's all this software, this Melodyne, which I use because you want to deliver a certain quality. But you can stuff like AutoTune you can hear. I don't know if you can hear Melodyne very much, but everybody uses Melodyne. It's like editing a film.
Got it.
It's like they go away and if somebody's even a little bit off, Melodyne fixes it vocally.
It just tweaks it, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, but when you're live on stage, obviously, like, you're not using stuff like that. Because I get a sense that there's more power. There's more, like, if you listen to yourself live on stage and if you listen to yourself once you're, like, in the studio, do you favor one or the other?
Live. I'm much better live.
Yeah.
Yeah, because live is immediate and you got to get it right. And I have all the energy around me. I have to, you know, be on for my audience and my band, you know. I'm like pitch and everything. I'm better live. Because in the studio, you get all these chances and, you know, you can mess around and you get drunk and you smoke a bunch of weed. And, you know what I mean? So you have all this time. You can go back and do it tomorrow. But live, you got one shot, you know?
Yeah. So it's like the stakes are higher when you're live.
Yeah. So you, I usually rise to the occasion live. But in the studio, I know I got, you know, all those machines you were talking about. And I don't know, it's mental.
Yeah. And a number of takes also, right? If you need it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't need a lot of takes though. I'm pretty good in the studio, but just live, I'm much better.
So you mentioned you ended up, you went to USC for school. What did you actually go to study when you went there?
Screenwriting.
Where did that come from? Were you into movies or writing when you were younger also?
Yeah, I had, that was actually my little gift. I was good with the pen. I could like write my way through school. Like if I'd mess up in class, I'd write these really nice letters to my teachers. And I could always write. So when I was applying for colleges, I wasn't really interested in anything yet. My mother wanted me to be a doctor because she knew doctors made a lot of money. But I had no interest in science. The only thing I could do was write, so I applied to only writing programs. So Stanford had a creative writing, USC had screenwriting. I forget the other schools I applied to. But I only applied to schools in California because I wanted to live in California. And I only applied to schools that had writing programs. And I got in all of them.
Oh, that's amazing. What made you end up in USC? Was it because it was LA or something else?
I think probably they gave me the most money.
Got it. Yeah.
Knowing my parents, that's what it was.
And it's how it is for so many of us, right? It's sort of like, okay.
Yeah.
They're all good, but happened. Like, what do you got? Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you writing just for yourself when you were a kid? Like, were you doing poetry or stories or anything else? Or it was really just more like for school?
I can write anything. I still can. I could, like, you know, I could do poetry. Anytime we had essays and stuff, and I got through college with that. I used to write papers for people for money.
No kidding.
Yeah, I used to write essays and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what you got to do. So you're in school, but it sounds like even though the music bug didn't take when you were a kid on the piano, it does start to take when you're in college.
Mm-hmm.
What? How does that start to touch down?
Just that was a lot of the, my friends were music students, and I hung out with them a lot, and they would always getting together writing and going to the studio and stuff like that. And it just kind of grew on me. I don't know. I started doing shows with this band, this little jazz band. I couldn't really sing, but it was just so much fun to me.
Yeah.
And then I got out of school, and I actually started working in movies because I still thought I was going to be like a big shot movie producer. I thought I was going to like write movies and be like Steven Spielberg.
Yeah. Oh, so you're still like in school the whole time. Like the music's happening on the side, but you're still focused on, okay, I'm going to be a writer or a screenwriter.
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding.
Because that's what I went to school for. Yeah. So I thought that's what I was going to do.
Right. So was your first step out? I mean, did you try and find a sort of like a regular or mainstream gig like in the movie industry?
Yeah, I was a PA for a while. You know, PA production assistant.
Yeah, right. The one with the headsets or like telling people when they
get. We don't even get a headset. That's the first thing.
Oh, man.
PAs are like, go flush the toilet. Like, you go do whatever. It's a horrible job.
You got to work your way up.
But I did that for like 2 years. I was waitress. I used to clean this photographer's studio. I did all kinds. I worked at McDonald's, Wendy's. I did all that stuff.
Yeah, basically anything you need to do.
Yeah.
So, and music was just kind of happening in the background for you at that point.
Yeah, I was in a band the whole time.
Got it. Same band or bopping around with different bands?
Different one. Like I put together my own band after I got out of school. It was a rock band. And we used to play all that. So back then, I don't know how it is now, the up and coming, what they have to go through. But back then, they call it the Strip.
Yeah.
And there's all these live clubs on the Strip. Right. It's on Sunset mostly. Yep. And then
I think it's kind of the same probably, isn't it?
I don't know. You know, I haven't kept up. All those clubs are still there. The
Roxy, right.
But I don't really know how it works. But back then we had pay to play. So you had to pay and then you could do a show at these clubs.
Right. Yeah. Or it's almost like, I know this happens in the comedy world. Does this happen in the music world also where it's like they call them bringer shows? Mm-hmm. Where it's like you got to bring you get an hour or 30 minutes on the stage, but you got to bring a certain amount of people to basically pay the cover or like buy booze.
Yeah, we had to buy tickets. So we had to buy our own tickets and then we could go sell the tickets. But none of our friends had any money. So that was all that was all in vain. But you had to buy like, gosh, I'm going to age myself right now. It was only maybe $200 back then.
Yeah.
But that was like hard for us to scrape up.
Yeah.
Between the four of us.
I mean, if you're just getting by. So it's kind of funny. So it's like, you buy tickets, like you work your day job to basically buy tickets to give to your friends to come for free.
Exactly, because they don't have right. I know, because the only way you're making money back is if they pay $10 each and they're like, I'm not paying $10, come see you. You know what I mean? I don't even have $10.
Right, it's like, so, and plus, you're my friend. I mean, come on.
Yeah, and then half of them wouldn't even show up anyway. So we'd be playing for like 10 people. But we, you know, but I don't know, when you're that young, you don't really care about that kind of stuff. You just want to play.
Yeah, I hear you. In those bands, were you singing or were you playing instruments or were you just sort of like mixing it up different things or?
No, I was singing, but I was doing a lot of the writing and with my band and stuff like that. We actually put out a couple songs that I did back then.
Oh, no kidding.
On my late albums. Mm-hmm.
Do you have those somewhere still?
Yeah, there's a song called Sweet Baby that was on my second album. There was a song called Harry that was on my second album. I wrote I Try, of course, back then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious actually how you actually stepped into the role of singing, because when you're hanging out like and you're creating a jazz band, what was it in you that said, okay, I want to be the singer? Because, you know, you got a whole bunch of players. What made you say, this is the role I want to play? Like, I want to sing. And then also, like, how did you feel about your voice when you start singing?
I wasn't crazy about it. I thought it was pretty peculiar. I just enjoyed it. I couldn't stay away from it. And I really liked being on stage. And I liked the hustle. I liked trying to get my friends there. You know, that was in social media. So you had to, like, go all over Hollywood and put your stickers. We had to make stickers, like band stickers. I don't think anybody does. Do people still do that?
I don't even know. Stickers? No, I remember, like, you used to make, like, give all, like, the little invites and hang them out. I think we're a similar age also. It's like, I remember all that stuff.
Flyers, like, standing on the street, right. Giving people flyers and... So that's so, but I just, like, for some reason, I was so attached to that. And then I used to send our demo tapes. That's how old I am. We had demo tapes. They were cassettes.
Yeah.
And we used to, there was this magazine. What was it called? Music something. There was like a weekly trade magazine for musicians, and it always had listed all the A&R and their phone numbers.
So that's not going to happen today.
No. So we used to call them up and send them our tapes and stuff like that. And I don't know. That was just so much fun to me.
Yeah.
I was so into it. I used to dream about it.
I mean, did you think at that point, like, okay, so I want this to be my thing. Like, this is my career. Or were you still hanging on to, look, I'm working whatever jobs I can. I'm doing music because I just love it. But I still kind of, like, want to work my way into screenwriting in some way, shape, or form.
I wasn't doing PA stuff. I just thought that's what I would do because that's what I went to school for. That was just in my head, you know what I mean? But I was spending all my time on music. So, and I don't think I knew what was going to happen. I think I knew in the back of my head that it was reachable, that I could get there somehow.
Yeah.
Like it seemed, that felt possible to me for some reason.
Right. Okay, so you're fresh out of USA. You're gigging around LA. You come from this, you know, like awesome sort of like, you know, Ohio value set, and your mom wants you to be a doctor or something like that.
Yeah.
What's going through your parents' minds, and what are the conversations with them after you're out of school and you're like, this music thing is sort of like drawing me in, and were they sort of curious about what you were up to?
Yeah. I don't know. My parents kind of let me be on my, because like I said, that's that Midwest thing. Like in Ohio, when you're 18, you're an adult. It's not like we do now. Like we have 25-year-olds living in our houses. They didn't do that. So I was on my own. So I think they were just letting me be on my own. I think they were just, you know, they figured I'd figure it out. Like they, you know, they weren't really bashing me or encouraging me either way. They did not think I could sing. My mother was very clear. She says, you cannot sing. You need to let that go.
Oh, no kidding.
She did. She said, you need to figure out what you're going to do. I don't know what you're going to do, but you need to stop trying to sing. I remember that conversation.
What was that like when your mom tells you that? Did you believe her at any point?
No, you know, I was at that age. I didn't really listen to my mom. But I vividly remember that conversation. You know, when people tell you stuff like that, you just want to do it more. You don't want nobody telling you what you can't do. That's right. The worst thing you can tell somebody.
Especially a parent.
Yeah.
Especially like with a kid in the 20s.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Okay, you just gave me all the ammunition I need to go all in on this one thing.
Yeah, they just don't want to talk to you for a week. That's all that accomplishes.
Right. So, but in their mind, basically, as long as you're paying your rent, you're taking care of yourself, it's kind of like you do your thing.
Yeah, I mean, I was still like needing money from my dad and I was putting my food on their credit card and stuff like that.
But. Yeah.
So that's the thing they would call about. Like, why are you putting another pizza on my credit card? That's the conversations I was having.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Good Life Project is sponsored by Lumi. So listen, we have all had those awkward moments where a BO strikes at the worst possible time. I'm often actually out in nature when I'm exercising, so I don't even notice it when I'm out. And then I walk in the door, kind of start to wrinkle my nose, and then I'm like, oh, wait a minute, that's actually me. That is why I'm so thankful I discovered Lumi Whole Body Deodorant. This revolutionary product, it was actually invented by an OBGYN who wanted a solution for her patients struggling with private odor. But Lumi doesn't just work, quote, down there. It provides incredible 72-hour protection for your entire body using mandelic acid. I kid you not, this stuff is a game changer. Lumi is safe and effective for pits, for feet, you name it. And as someone who's tried it, I can attest that it seriously works. The fresh scents are just 10% added bonus. So if you're ready to say goodbye to BO for good, try Lumi Starter Pack. It comes with a solid stick deodorant, cream tube deodorant, two free products of your choice like mini body wash and deodorant wipes, and free shipping. As a special offer for our listeners, new customers get $5 off a Lumi Starter Pack with the code GOODLIFE at LumiDeodorant.com. Don't miss your chance to experience the relief of true full body freshness that equates to over 40% off your starter pack when you visit LumiDeodorant.com or just click the link in the show notes and use the code GOODLIFE. Good Life Project is sponsored by Quince. So my wife actually originally introduced me to Quince because she loves their clothing, and I have been hooked ever since. I literally lived in their Mongolian cashmere ribbed beanie and pullover hoodie pretty much all winter. And as the weather warms up, I wanted more breathable summer pieces without overpaying. And Quince has just the super high quality items like linen shirts, performance polos, activewear at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince partners directly with top factories, cutting out the middleman to pass savings to customers. Actually just ordered a new European linen long sleeve button down shirt. Super excited to get that. And I'm always just so amazed at how they can keep their prices so affordable while the quality remains really high. So if you're looking to upgrade your wardrobe, I highly recommend you try Quince. Go to quince.com/GLP for free shipping on your order and a 365-day return. That's quince.com/GLP to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/GLP or just click the link in the show notes. Trust me, your wardrobe will thank you. So you're gigging around, and at some point you meet Joe Solo.
Yeah.
And that sounds like that was kind of the catalyst to creating the demos that would eventually lead to the first time you got signed.
Yeah, that was, Joe was one of the bands. He's probably in the third band that I was with.
Got it.
Yeah.
Three simultaneously or?
No, like I had my band in college. Then I got out of college and I started this, like, it was like a hard rock band. Like literally all the guys had long hair and we did like proper Metallica.
Right.
And then I met Joe, and then we did another whole thing.
Do you have a picture of that, like you and the sort of like the hair metal band somewhere?
I do somewhere. I gotta dig that up. That's probably old.
That's awesome. Right, because that would have been sort of like late 80s, right?
Early
90s.
Now.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's sort of like the height of all
of
that.
Yeah, I got out of school in 91.
Right, so it's the height of all that stuff. So you, I mean, it sounds like you and Joe really start, were you co-writing? Were you recording? Were sort of like doing the demo thing? Because I think that turned into a really long-term collaboration too.
Yeah, we did demos. We did a million demos.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What was it? Because pretty soon after that was when you first got signed to Atlantic, right?
Yeah, so.
Or was there something in the middle there?
No, I got signed to Atlantic when I was with Joe. He didn't. He was on the Atlantic record.
So yeah, it like 97, 98-ish or something like that?
I forget. I remember I was 24, so I don't know, 90-something.
Yeah. 90. What was it like when a company in that, like Atlantic says, okay, you have a deal? Because especially in L.A., that's sort of like the dream.
Oh, yeah, that was huge. Yeah, you know, like when you get the record deal, because you don't know anything about the music business, so you think that's it. I got a record deal. I'm going to be in Michael Jackson, you know what I mean? By tomorrow. But it doesn't work like that. So, yeah, so I got signed. Right after I got signed, I got pregnant. And I made my album, and then they dropped me.
Mm. What was the reason that they gave you for dropping you?
I remember they got a new president, and they didn't really give me a reason. They just stopped. That was it.
Yeah.
It was like, they don't want to put your record out. We made a whole record. We did the cover and everything.
Oh, so you made it, but they wouldn't even put it. They didn't put it out.
No.
When something like that happens, because I don't know this, do you get the rights on the music to then keep it and do something else with it, or do they just own it no matter what?
No, they own it. That's the big jack you get when you sign a record deal. Unless, you know, at this point, I would never sign over everything, but. And then back then, everything's perpetuity.
Right.
So once you sign a record deal, they have it forever.
So basically, they could just take an album and sit on it and never release it, or decide, mm-hmm. like, 20 years later, if you get famous, oh, look what we have.
Yeah, exactly.
That's changed a lot now, though, hasn't it? Or not so much?
Not really.
Really?
No. Only thing that's really changed is, you know, of course, streaming is how people hear music, which speaks to what artists get in return for that. But most record deals are, you know, they take the record, yeah.
Yeah. You're pregnant.
Because they pay for it. It's like if you pay for a hamburger, it's right. Your hamburger.
Yeah. So you're pregnant with your first kid. Atlantic drops you.
Mm-hmm.
What's going through your mind at that point?
Having a healthy baby. I just wanted to have healthy. I remember that being my, because I used to party a lot. I was drinking. Me and my ex-husband smoked, you know, like we did everything. So I remember just being really stressed out about my baby being healthy.
Yeah. So everything kind of focuses on that at that point.
Yeah, and then we got married, and I didn't get married on my first one. I moved in with him, though. And that was crazy. But I kept playing. I was doing shows 7-8 months pregnant. I was working.
Yeah.
I was still doing everything.
So you're still out gigging, and everything else is happening, but the record deal is something on the side that kind of goes away.
Yeah.
I mean, in your mind, when something like that happens, because you're young, too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think to yourself, well, okay, I'm just not right for them, or they're not right for me, but something else will come along? Or do you think, like, I had my shot and, like, that was it?
Yeah, I didn't know what was going to happen. I kept playing, so obviously I felt like it wasn't over. And that's really, at that point, that's the only thing I figured I could do well, and where I knew people and I knew the music scene and stuff. So I stayed stuck with that. I was doing, like, temp jobs, like office jobs,
yeah,
stuff like that.
Did you stay in LA the whole time after that?
Yep.
Right. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of heads down, still performing, still writing also. So, so how does, because pretty shortly after that, you end up back with Epic, right?
No, I actually had my baby and then I got pregnant again.
Okay. So a couple of years where you're essentially becoming a mom and yeah, raising a family.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, still out playing a lot.
Yeah, I was still playing.
So how do you sort of step back into the world of recording? And was Epic this really then? Because it was Epic that then releases the album with I Tried pretty shortly after that, right?
Yeah, so, okay, so a lot happened.
Yeah.
So,
walk me through it.
Okay, so I have two kids now, and I'm just working. It's me and my ex-husband, and we live in the Valley. I'm still doing music, like making songs and stuff, but it's different because I have two now.
Yeah.
And him and me aren't getting along at all, but I'm still kind of sending out my tapes and stuff. And then we separated. I moved back in with my mother, with my two kids, because I'm pregnant again.
Right. Oh, in Ohio or in a...
I was pregnant with my third, and I moved back to Ohio, stay with my mom, because me and my husband.
Yeah.
And then it was so weird. I'm at home, and I get a call from Zomba Publishing, which is now Universal.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah.
And, so this guy named Jeff, so he says, he got a hold of my demo tape. Must have been something I had sent out a long time ago. And he was listening to stuff, and he wanted to get together and meet about a publishing deal. So I'm like 8 months pregnant, and I just went through that thing with Atlantic.
Living in Ohio. Right.
I know. So I said, oh, you know, I'm really busy. I can't meet with you right now. And I said, maybe I can meet with you, you know, like maybe sometime in October. And he was like, what? You know.
Right. It's like people don't do this. Do you, like,
I know. But looking back, I think that's what made him want me more.
Right.
I'm busy, you know. So, so sure enough, he calls back like a week before I have my kid. And I said, oh, yeah, I'm still really tied up. So I'll call you when I'm available. So I have my kid, my third one. And literally, he calls me that next day. He didn't know I was having a baby. But he called me the next day, and we set up for me to go out to New York. I went out to New York. Like 2 days later, my brother drove me out there. And then I met with him and the president of Zomba. And I got signed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had my kid in October, and I had my publishing deal before the end of the year.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like in the blink of an eye, it's just everything changes to a certain extent.
I know. They offered me $35,000, which was a fortune to me back then. And then I moved back to L.A. I was back in L.A. by January.
Got it. Then, so was it a deal to write, to produce, like for an album or for songs? Or?
Yeah, it was just for the songs that I Try was on there.
Yeah.
And so he was signing me. But at the same time, he was shopping me. Because a lot of people don't know, publishers, like, it behooves them to help you get a record deal because that's how they're going to sell their song. Okay, so he was shopping me to all these labels. And before you know it, I had a bidding war. I had like 8 labels after me.
No kidding. Mm-hmm. Wow. What was going through your head when you go from being at home with your mom, having your third kid, 2 days later, you're in New York, sign a publishing deal, and then all of a sudden he's wrapping you around and there's a bidding war for an album. Mm-hmm. What's going through your head when all this is happening?
I'm still enjoying my 35 grand, by the way. And then, you know, I had kids and
right.
Yeah, this was all super new to me. And like I said, I still didn't know the business. So I didn't know. I knew it was cool to have 8 labels after you, of course, but I didn't know the gravity. Like, I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know how big of a deal that was.
Yeah.
And then I did the showcase and everybody was there. Doug Morris was there. Polly Anthony, like all these big, you know, like all the top people of the record business, but I didn't know who they were.
Right.
So I was fine.
Yeah.
Which was good because I just performed.
Right. Was this in a conference room in one of their places or at a small club or something like that?
It was at this, they rented out a private room in this club back then called Luna.
Yeah.
And it was probably maybe 30 people there. They were all there, but I didn't know. Jason Flom was there. So I did my show, and then a bunch of people made offers, and I ended up going with Epic.
Yeah, that's amazing. So at that point also, you're like, okay, this is incredible. I mean, all these people are bidding after me. But at the same time, you kind of know you were signed once before, and it's just because that happens doesn't necessarily mean really big things are going to happen to you. Are you sort of like a little bit more cautious as you're sort of, you know, like going into this a collaboration with Epic at that point? Or were you just all in again? You're like, you know what, I'm let's just do this.
Yeah, I was just all in. I was really like, I was so lucky to not know anything.
Yeah.
So like, it never occurred to me I might get dropped again. I just wanted to make my album. I was really excited about all these new songs that I wrote. And I was actually fighting with Epic because I wanted my producer who was helping me write at the time, and they wanted another producer because without explaining it to me, they didn't want me to be an R&B artist. They didn't want me to, because they felt like my music was a little more crossover, a little different.
Mm.
So they didn't want to put me out as like the next, you know, Mary J or whatever. And my demos were very like R&B hip hop. Like that's the kind of artist I thought I was going to be.
Oh, so they're like, okay, so we heard the demo. Mm-hmm. We see what you're capable of, but we want to slide you into a different genre.
Yeah, but they didn't talk to me about that. They just were like,
first,
you know,
let's sign you.
Yeah. Here's the producer. So I thought I was going to be like, you know, like this proper underground artist, you know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just make like little records and stuff. I really wasn't thinking about it because that's kind of what I had always been.
Yeah. Right.
That's what I knew, thought of myself. And then, so they brought in Andy Slater, who's this Jewish tall white guy. I was like, are you kidding me? You know, he's not a musician at all.
But to, to produce or to engineer?
Produce.
Yeah.
He's not, but he's very smart. He knows how records are supposed to sound. And he was managing Fiona Apple and the Wallflowers.
Right. Which then were huge. Both of them were huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they brought in Andy, and Andy kind of, I mean, we fought the whole time, but he ended up getting whatever he wanted because he was just kind of that way. He could kind of talk you into anything.
Mm.
And so, and that turned out to be the record we made.
Yeah. Mm. But I mean, at the end of the day, that wasn't really an R&B record.
I don't even know how
you categorize it.
I know. I think that's why they brought him in, because they didn't want me like into one little thing.
Right. Yeah. And that's the record that I try and lands up on.
Yeah, that's how life is.
Right. So that record, when you're done with that record, you're like, okay, you're like, it's wrapped. It's, you know, we got the master done. We're going to market. Do you have any sense, any, like even the smallest sense for what was about to happen once that record actually made its way out into the public?
No. No, they put the record out. And I remember first thing Andy did was put me on the road. So I was going to Europe a lot. I'd already done the UK. And I was like seeing the world. I'm still in my 20s. I have 3 kids. I'm away from my nightmare marriage. And I'm meeting all these new people. Like everybody on my tour had a DJ too. I had about a 12-piece band. They're all in their 20s. This is all new to all of us. We're partying. We're having a blast. You know, I brought my sister to babysit, which was a disaster. She ended up leaving, going home. And so I had the backup singers babysitting for me. I made them take turns. It was like...
It's like a rotation.
Yeah, and then my DJ had a tech, and I had him babysit on nights. Like, I just made my band rotate. It was my first time I got to be a boss and tell everybody what I wanted to do. And I was kind of enjoying that. And so... I remember when my record came out and I sold, I think it was 8,992 records. Cause I remember Polly called me and she says, you sold 8,992 records. And I screamed, I was the happiest. You would have thought I sold 10 million records. I was the happiest person in the world because I had never sold records before. I mean, of course they were disappointed, but I was on cloud nine. I thought I had made it, you know?
Right.
And then,
So are they thinking in the back of their mind, oh no, like this is not happening, even though you're thinking this is awesome, but.
No, I don't think they, because you know what? Now that I know the record business, because I had that big bidding war, because they spent so much money on my record, like they didn't have a choice. Like Polly didn't have a choice. She had to bring my record home. I didn't know that then, but I know how it works now. So, but it's a good thing I didn't know. I would have just done things a lot differently and I probably would have messed up a lot of stuff. So anyway, so I just kept touring and they were putting out my records and I would hear them on the radio and I thought life was great. And I remember it kept going up and then one week it went all the way down. Like I sold 2,000 records one week. And then I was in the UK and I had just done this place called Shepherd's Bush. In the UK, that's about 1,000 people. That's the most people I had ever played for. Andy calls me and he says, your record is number one. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, that means that they play your record more than anybody else's in the whole country.
What's going through your mind when you hear that?
he goes, you got, Jay-Z got 9,000 spins this week. You got 9,800 or something like that. And I was like, oh, and my only, all I'm thinking is, wow, I beat Jay-Z. That's all I could think about. I didn't really know what that meant because I had never, like, I was never one to look on the charts. Like, when you're a fan, as a fan, I never cared who was number one. I just was liking the songs that I liked. So all of a sudden now I'm looking at charts and stuff like that. But that was kind of my first taste of what it was like to be popular.
Yeah.
And by their standards. Selling a lot of records.
Yeah, because and from there, that album just kind of explodes.
Yeah,
and it sounds like I mean it's a great album, but also largely, you know, this one song becomes massive, all over the place. I mean, to the point where it ends up like winning all these awards. It puts you on the award shows. How are you? I mean, because you go from, you know, working really hard in the LA scene. Having a family, coming back, doing this album, and then gigging around the UK in various different places, kind of like not really even entirely knowing what's happened with the album back in the US. And then all of a sudden, poof, it explodes. Ton of attention, ton of media. From a success standpoint, I mean, now, you know, like you're selling millions and millions of copies. That is a financial success in the album's eyes also. How are you just handling it, like psychologically and emotionally? How are you kind of like handling that moment in time? And a lot of fame also, a lot of eyeballs on you.
Yeah. It was really new. I definitely had an asshole period where I was, you know, thought I was, you know, God's gift, and I was acting that way, and suddenly I was getting whatever I wanted. You know, I could go to wherever I wanted, and if I wanted to fly private, they'd fly me private. And it's kind of this thing where you really can do whatever you want, and if you're not, I don't know any human that wouldn't enjoy that and wouldn't exploit it and wouldn't abuse it a little bit. I mean, that's not even normal. So I definitely went through that. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the same time also, I know you've been really open about as that fame sort of like started coming your way mm-hmm. and you're really enjoying all this stuff. Also, you sort of like step into the world where there's also a lot of drugs, a lot of different kinds of drugs. Mm-hmm. And coming from Ohio as a, from what I understand, also a fairly straight-laced kid, mm-hmm. this is kind of a new world. I mean, granted, yes, you were in LA before that, but this is sort of like the access to substances and to money and to fame on an entirely different level. Mm-hmm. And that became a bigger part of your world for a window of time.
Well, I think I get people have this perspective of me as I'm this horrible drug addict, I was just partying a lot. I was probably in my, I think when I came out, I was 28, 29, I don't know. So, and I had never done that before. I'd never been like, you know, a big drinker. I could barely smoked weed before. I smoked a little bit, but I was not like a big weed head, but I liked pot. But that was it, you know. I had never done blow before. First time I did ecstasy, I was in Europe. And so all of a sudden I have access to all this stuff. And because a couple of my songs were about getting stoned, people assumed I was this big pothead. So I'd do shows and people would literally throw joints on stage. So we just had all this stuff and then we go to Europe. And at that time, that's when MDMA started becoming a really big deal, like the pure, like the good stuff. I don't know what they're doing now. Back then it was like a little powder and it was pure. So everybody was just trying stuff. And I think I did get attached to it because it felt good. And I would write these incredible songs when I was high, like great songs. Like we did Mushrooms one night and I wrote the best song. I don't even remember it, but it was just an incredible song in my mind.
Right. In the moment, there's like, yeah. This is the best song ever.
Exactly. So it was more access. It was more just, I had access to all this stuff. And, you know, there's no moderate way to do drugs. Like, you can think, oh, I just do blow on the weekends. But if you do blow on the weekends, then you're attached. You know what I mean? If you do it more than once, you kind of have a problem at that point because it affects your life so tremendously. But,
yeah, I mean, also,
and it does take over a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, I mean, when you're thinking to yourself, you know, I think about like the Beatles talked about their time where they're doing a lot of LSD and like to expand their mind and like write all this amazing music. But then I think about a lot of other people that I know that have been through windows like that who are either performing artists or, you know, in music business. Mm-hmm. And when they look back at what they thought was this incredible work, when they're sort of looking at these mind expanding substances, once they were sort of like sober and like reflecting on it, they're like, oh, wow, that's not what I actually thought it was.
I know. I do have an album. I won't admit to what one it was. But I thought it was the greatest album, and I'm yelling at Epic, like, why can't you sell this album? And I listened to it, like, maybe about 6 months ago, and it's horrible. I was like, what is that? My voice is bad. The production is terrible. Whoever engineered it must have been on drugs with me. It's terrible. But yeah, you don't realize that till later.
Yeah.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com. Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig.
Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I mean, in the middle of the solstice, that comes out, and you start working on a series of follow-up albums too, but also it's kind of interesting because that early interest in screenwriting and the movie business kind of starts to sneak back in, you know, like both you on screen and also with music. So it's almost like that thing, was that kind of always brewing in the background, or had you pretty much left it behind and then all of a sudden you got these opportunities to sort of like step back into it in different ways?
No, I still write, actually, but in the end, me doing movies was totally just fell in my lap. I never thought I'd be doing any acting, but I got offers to do stuff. And,
yeah, because the very first one Training Day, or was there something else there?
Training Day.
Right. So the first time is you on screen with one of the most iconic actors of our time, Denzel. Right?
Yeah. I know.
How does that land in your lap? How does that come to you?
That was cool because I wasn't going to do it because, like I said, I didn't see myself as an actress. And then when he told me that Denzel was in it, I told him I'd do it because I wanted to get pictures with Denzel to show my mom because I wasn't taking him seriously at all. But you know, when you're on set and there's people looking, you want to do good. You don't want to make a fool of yourself. So I got myself together and I learned my part and I got an acting coach and all that stuff.
Yeah,
I did my thing, but yeah, that really fell in my lap. I lucked up on that one.
Yeah, when you do that, because I know you probably get a certain feeling when you're on stage, when you're like, when you're either recording or on stage, that makes you, it's almost just kind of like amazing. There's like a merging of you and the audience and the moment and the music. Do you get any similar sense of that from acting or not so much?
No, it's just different. For me, acting is much more of a study. It's much more of a, you know, preparing and learning your lines. And then you have to, you know, study your character. And there's all these notes you make. Like the method I'm learning, like you have to, every line that the character reads, you have to write what they mean by that. Like, you know how you say stuff that you don't mean or vice versa. So you have to go through every line and dissect what the character's thinking behind what they're saying. And then you kind of start dressing like the character and all that Robert De Niro stuff, you know. So it's much more of a study, much more of a, for me. I'm sure to somebody like Meryl Streep, she can probably do it in her sleep by now. She probably doesn't have to do all that.
Yeah.
But I have to.
But you know? It sounds like you really approached it like a student. Like, if I'm going to do this, let me study. Were you taking lessons or working with a coach and stuff like that?
Yeah, I'm still very much student of it. But I've been on sets where, you know, I was on a set with Nicole Kidman and she had her coach there. And, you know, I've sat with actors who told me they spent 7 months prepping for their part and stuff like that. So it really is a study. And I think you're always a student of whatever you do. You know, I'm still learning music. I learn stuff about singing every day. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like music and acting, like one makes you better at the other in any way, or one gives you material for the other in any way?
For acting, just through my singing, because only way I really can get a message across is if I'm just completely like empty of myself. I have to be all heart. You know what I mean? Like when I get behind the mic, I can't have nothing in my head. I can't have, you know, nothing on my mind. Everything has to flow from one place. So I try to bring that to my acting, but it doesn't come as naturally as it does for what I'm singing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess especially, I guess maybe like even the closer part of the music business would be when you're recording in a studio, right? Because you don't have the responsiveness of the energy of the audience. It's kind of like, you know, there's other people involved and very likely multiple takes and trying it this way and trying it that way. But
yeah,
it's like you said on stage, you got one shot, it's high stakes, like we're all in this together.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. The smile on your face when you just like thought about that was like, that seems like, is that your happy place?
Yeah, I feel I'm really comfortable on stage. Probably a little too comfortable. But like I said, you know, when I get on stage, I'm in that space where I don't have, there's nothing on me just but that. Like I spend the whole day getting everything off me. And I don't like to do interviews. If anybody has bad news for me, they gotta wait. I pray. Like I just wanna be a vessel. Like I just wanna own what I have, you know, my art for the night. You know what I mean? And then when I get off stage, everything can come down. But when I'm up there, that's all I want to have on me, you know? So that's the only time in life you can really do that.
Yeah.
I think.
No, I totally
for
get
me
it.
For me anyway.
The closest thing I've ever experienced to that, I speak also. So like, mm-hmm. I know, you know, if there's a couple thousand people waiting for me to step on stage for an hour, some people I know for the couple hours before, they just want to socialize with everyone. They want to talk. I kind of hide out.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want, I'm just like in my head, sort of like, you know, like being in my own space.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I can't socialize. I really don't want no phone calls because people say things and they weigh on you and they don't mean to. Like somebody could say, your bed isn't made. And, you know, all of a sudden you're thinking about your bed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, but when you know, that's why it's just good to just go in where you got nothing else on you. And then, because then you're giving your audience all you got. It's hard. If you give them all that other stress, and then they feel that too. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, completely. It's kind of funny because it also, to a certain extent, I think that ties in. So was it 2018 Ruby came out?
Uh-huh.
Right? And that's a lot of the theme of that album, right? It feels like this is an album that's contemplative, like you're reflecting a lot. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is about being in the present moment, right? Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the song Buddha, right? Mm-hmm. It's really about like, I'm just focusing on what's happening in this moment right here, which is a lot of what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's important.
Do you feel like that's a sort of like a theme in your life these days?
I just learned that it's the most important because I have a lot of hangups about my past and things I wish I would have done different in my career with my kids, with, you know, with my love affairs. I mean, we all do, I guess. So, and it's easy to dwell on that. It's easy to beat yourself up. That's the easiest thing in the world, to kick yourself all day. You know what I mean? So I'm just learning to get in, you know, to be at where I'm at. I don't know how better to say it. Like to get to where I'm at instead of, because I wasted a lot of time trying to fix what I did before. And I found out you can't really, because people don't forget what you say or what you did. And you can try to clean stuff up, but you already made a mess. You know what I mean? And there's forgiveness and that's all cool and in the movies. But at the end of the day, when you hurt somebody, they're hurt. You know what I mean? And so you can just try not to hurt anymore. That's really all you can do, is just try to do better next time. That's my life.
Yeah, and it seems like that's, I mean, especially thinking about the album, like it's kind of like a central thing for you. That song, by the way, I love that you got Gary Clark Jr.
Buddha.
Ripping on guitar in the background and
yeah.
that. I mean, just somebody who blows my mind with sort of like the skills. Actually, he came up a lot with Jimmy Vaughn back, like down in Austin.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He's amazing.
Yeah. So, such a talent. Such like an amazing person.
Have you ever talked to him?
I haven't. No, I'd love to at some point. So we'll try and get him in the studio. And also you're at this moment too. So like, because your kids were in their 20s now, right?
Early 20s.
Yeah. Right. So in theory, they're out of the house and adults.
They're not. They're not. I so wish I had followed my mother's footsteps. Kicked them out a long time ago. Yeah, that's my advice to parents. If you let them stay past 2021, they're going to be there when they're 25.
Yeah.
No, not necessarily, but it's cool. We're doing good.
When they think about you, well, actually, I'm curious, you know, when they're coming up as kids in this environment of fame and busyness and travel, have you talked to them at all or sort of like had conversations over the years about what that's been like for them?
Yeah, a little. I think it's all different for them because I have three and they all have taken it in very differently. Like my son was telling me how when he was little, he thought that the way we lived was normal because by the time they were 7, 8, we were doing really well, you know? And he thought that that was the norm and that everybody's mom, people wanted to take pictures of them. He didn't realize that what we had was unique until I think he told me that when he was like 12 or 13. No, not that late. Maybe 10. And then it's so funny, like 6 months ago, he came to go to me and he goes, Mom, I'm sad. Like he was shocked that he was sad. Like his life has been so good that he wasn't used to having down moments. So he's going to think where I think reality is hitting him, where he's realizing what it really is, you know, instead of how, you know, some of the things have been, you know, just kind of dropped from the sky for him. And then my oldest daughter, very evolved. She's actually more grown up than I am. So, and then I have another daughter who's 22 and she thinks she's 50 and she doesn't know hardly anything. So they all take, you know, they're all different people. So they all took it differently. You know what I mean?
I mean, it's interesting you brought up your son just sort of like experiencing that for the first time. Did you go through waves like that at all, sort of like along the way also? I mean, I know, you know, that you came to a reckoning with drugs and other stuff like that and made a lot of different choices to clean things up. Were there windows just from a mindset standpoint where you went through lulls or depression or feelings on that side?
Oh, yeah. I was depressed for like 2 years.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, I was like in and out of my bed for like 2 years.
What was that about? I mean, looking back, do you have a sense?
No, because I think when you're depressed, like when you're genuinely, like when I think there's a difference. Like people, when they're down, and they say I'm depressed because that's just such a catchy word. But real depression, I think sometimes you don't even know what's happening. You know, you just can't seem to get moving.
Yeah.
What, you know what I mean?
What got you out of that window?
Nothing in particular. I think it just, because I don't do meds and stuff. So I just kind of had to wait it out. I mean, I was still like going through the motions and doing stuff I had to do, but just really unhappy and not realizing that was what I was going through. It's like there's one thing if you get up and you go to therapy and they say, well, let me give you this pill and you need to do this and then there's that where you're dealing with it. But I think like when you're really, really depressed, I'll speak for myself again. I didn't really know what I was going through. I just knew that all I wanted to do was go home and go to bed. You know what I mean? Yeah.
I think that's part of it for so many people. It's sort of, you don't know exactly what it is and I think one of the big things that is you don't know if it's ever going to end.
Yeah.
Which is one of the biggest things that, you know, part of that struggle.
Yeah, because you don't know it's supposed to end. I just thought, oh, I'm just being lazy. I just didn't want to do anything. Like, I had no motivation. And I didn't want to post on my Instagram. I didn't want to do nothing, you know. I mean, I'd get up and get myself together because my life is pretty active and I have a lot of stuff on my schedule. But I started canceling stuff and a lot of like invites, you know, like my friend's birthdays. I just didn't want to go. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you kind of just don't know that that's what you're going through. You just don't want to do anything.
Yeah. So as we sit here today, I mean, you're on the road. Weird times for sure.
Oh my God.
But like when you think about what's really exciting you right now, like what is it that you're really sort of like excited about?
I'm really excited about putting out records. I got a lot of ideas, and as much as I despise what the record industry has done to itself, I'm excited about just exploiting that and just putting records out. And because it has allowed you that. You can now put out a record whenever you want. I can put out a record. Like, we can make this a record, like a conversation, and we can put it on Spotify.
Done.
And say, here's a record. And we would get hits for sure. We'd probably get a lot. And so that's exciting. So that's kind of like, I woke up today and I want to go to the studio because I got this idea. And the way things are now, I can put it out next week if I want. So I'm excited to see what that's like, just to put records out.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. I love that. Mm-hmm. So let's come full circle. We're hanging out here in this container with Good Life Project podcast.
Yeah.
And so if I offer up this phrase, to live a good life, what comes up for you?
To live a good life, good food. And I think it's important to really love someone. And I don't say that to be corny, but it's necessary to feel that, you know, for somebody, and to have that come back to you some kind of way. And what else? I think a good life is seeing the world. It's good to see what's around you and what the world has to offer, because you get so inundated with what's going to be taken away from you. You know what I mean? And what you can't do, and what's not safe, and you know, because everybody says, be safe, be careful. So automatically you're stressed because it's like, oh, something might happen. You know what I mean? You're like, nobody ever says, just, you know, go out and do whatever you want. You know what I mean? I go out and laugh a lot. Nobody ever says that. They say, oh, you know, don't touch anybody. So I think good times are important. I think it's very important to have fun and use up your moments. You know what I mean? Like, just make your days count, regardless of what everybody's telling you to be scared of or what not to do. Like, just know that your day is big. Even if you are laying in bed all day, it's a big day. Like, what are you going to do while you're in bed? Do you know what I'm saying? Or if you do want to not go out because you're afraid of getting sick, then what are you going to do while you're holed up in your house? Do you know what I mean? Like, that's a good life. Just like eating up, you know, what you got.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening, and thanks also to our fantastic sponsors who help make this show possible. You can check them out in the links we have included in today's show notes. And while you're at it, if you've ever asked yourself, what should I do with my life? We have created a really cool online assessment that will help you discover the source code for the work that you're here to do. You can find it at sparkatype.com. That's sparkatype.com, or just click the link in the show notes. And of course, if you haven't already done so, be sure to click on the subscribe button in your listening app so you never miss an episode. And then share the love. If there's something that you've heard in this episode that you would love to turn into a conversation, share it with people and have that conversation. Because when ideas become conversations that lead to action, that's when real change takes hold. See you next time.